Okay, we're starting here on the bottom of Mem Bet Amud Bet by the two dots. Vatem Iatem came. You're not like other nations, because when you come to battle, it's not you alone that's coming to battle, but rather Kadosh Baruch Hu is with you, is accompanying you into the battle. V'cholkach lama. How do you know? What does that mean that Kadosh Baruch Hu is coming into the battle with you? Bipnei Hashem v'chol kinuyav muruchim ba'aron. Because the Shem Hashem and all the kinuim of Hashem are placed in the Aron. Or in essence, you have a mini Mishkan, or a Shrat HaShchinah, that is joining the people as they enter into battle. And that's why it means that the Hashem Halukechem Haholeich Imachem. Hashem is going with you. It's not simply that Hashem is with you, but He's literally moving with you, going with you, because that's represented by the Aron. This actually relates to a bigger machloket about whether there were two aronot or one aron. The Yishalmi, as Tosva points out, believes there was one aron. The Bavli has different shitot, but there is a shit amongst the Bavli that there were two aronot. There was one aron that held the Shivrei Luchot, and that was the one that was taken out to battle. And there's another aron which held the whole Luchot, which was the aron that belonged in the Mikdash, in the Kodesh HaKodeshim, or in the Mishkan, in the Kodesh HaKodeshim. And so they're actually two separate aronot, one aron for battle, one aron for the Hashrat HaShchinah. And a lot of it revolves around the Psukim and Sefer Dvarim, which indicate that Moshe makes an aronates. And the question is, what is the connection or correlation between that aronates of Moshe and the aron that was in the Mishkan? So the Bavli has a view that there might have been two aronot, and this is the aron that went out to Milchama. Yerushalmi again has as a one, there is a Deah within the Bavli as well, that there was only one aron. V'cheinu Omer, it says in Bamidbar, when they go out to battle against Midian, it says, Vayishlach otam Moshe, elef lamateh, latzava, otam ved Pinchas. Otam, elu Sanhedrin. So who went out with them? The Sanhedrin. Pinchas, ze mashuach Milchama. Then the puzzle continues. Uchle HaKodesh, Zaron v'luchot shibo. The Aron with the Luchot. V'chatzot tzrot ha-truah, and the trumpets, ilu ha-shofarot. These are the shofarot. Why the Gemara needs to translate that seems strange, because it's literally the chatzot tzrot, the silver chatzot tzrot, were made for this purpose to be taken out to Milchama. So why does it translate it to shofarot? Because we have in other places, the Gemara discusses the fact that the word chatzot tzrot and shofarot actually changed, the meaning of them changed over time. And at some points, the word shofarot was synonymous with chatzotzrot, versus at other times when chatzotzrot meant chatzotzrot. So here, they're translating the chatzotzrot to say, the chatzotzrot mean the shofarot that we know, which are trumpets, not a shofar, like we call it today. Tana, lo lichinam alach Pinchas lamilchama. It was not for naught that Pinchas went out to this battle. Ela lipara din avi imo. But to take revenge for the father of his mother, Shinemar, because the Pasuk says in last week's parsha that we read, Vamidanim makru oto el Mitzrayim. The Midanim sell Yosef to Mitzrayim. Earlier on in the Psukim, it calls them the Midyanim. And whether they're different people or the same Midyanim, there's a lot of confusion, because twice in the parsha, Yosef is sold down to Mitzrayim. And the sequence of events and the parties involved, they're different each time, which leads Chazal to say that he was sold multiple times in order to reconcile the Psukim. But here it says, Midanim machru oto el Mitzrayim, and that's to Potifar, Sris Paro. The Memra, from this you would conclude, the Pinchas mi Yosef ati. So the meaning of this is that the battle against Midian is led by Pinchas, who's the Mashuach Milchama, because he's a descendant of Yosef. And in essence, it's revenge for the fact that the Midyanim sold Yosef into slavery in Mitzrayim. Now, the question that arises here is that Pinchas was already in the battle because he was the Mashuach Milchama. He didn't need to be in the battle because he was a descendant of Yosef. So what's this Braita telling us? So either you have to say that this Braita argues and says that Pinchas was there not because he was Mashuach Milchama, but rather because he was taking revenge for his ancestor Yosef, who was sold by the Midyanim, or you have to suggest that this is an additional reason why Pinchas was there, not just because he was Mashuach Milchama, but also this. The Maharal says something along the lines of what you're saying, which is that Pinchas was the Mashuach Milchama. And so it's only apropos, basically what the Maharal says is, Yes, he was going in as the Meshuach Milchama. But it was additionally apropos that he was the Meshuach Milchama because he had another personal vendetta that was involved here from his ancestors, Yosef. V'haktiv, Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, lakach lo mibnot Putiel lo liisha. So Elazar, who is the father of Pinchas, his wife is from the daughters of Putiel, and that is the wife of Elazar HaKohen. So now it's clear that Pinchas is not a descendant of Yosef from his father's side, because from the father's side he is a Kohen, and that's from Shevet Levi. So it must be from his mother's side that he is related to Yosef. So now it says that Elazar ben Aaron came lakach lo mibnot Putiel lo liisha my love the ati mitro. That what is Putiel? Putiel means a descendant of Yitro. Shepitaim agalim lavudat kochavim, because he fattened up cows for avodah zarah, or in essence was a Kohen to avodah zarah. So Mar says lo. That's not what the word Putiel means over here. Rather, it means Yosef shepitpeit biyitro. First, Yosef, who was able to, as Rashi says, overcome, kovesh et his yetzer. He was able to put it aside and overcome the seductions of Eshet Potiphar. Gemara says, v'alo shvatim yivazim oto. Didn't the shvatim make fun of or denigrate Pinchas? Re'item ben puti zeh? Do you see the son of this puti, ben shepitem avimo agalim labudat kochavim? The son of his grandfather, who was a priest to Avodah Zarah, Yerog Nasim Israel, he goes ahead and kills one of the princes of Israel. It's referring to when Pinchas kills the Nasi of Shimon because of the sin of the Benot Midian. And there they were negating the action of Pinchas as being right because his grandfather was an Oved Avodah Zarah. He kills the Nasi of Israel. So there is something wrong here in this picture. He's acting out of line. But that indicates, again, if they were speaking to him in this manner, that he was a descendant of Yitro, not a descendant of Yosef. Ela, Iavua Dimei mi Yosef, Imei Dimei mi Yitro. So again, it has to be through the mother's side that this relationship happens, because the fact that Elazar is a Kohen. So from his mother's side, Iavua Dimei mi Yosef, that his maternal grandfather was a descendant of Yosef, and his maternal grandmother was a descendant of Yitro. Or maybe the other way around. His maternal grandmother was from Yosef, and his maternal grandfather was from Yitro. His mother's two parents, one parent was a descendant of Yosef, one parent was a descendant of Yitro. Dekanami, you can be midayek that this is the case, dechtiv mibnot Putiel, trei mashma. Rashi indicates over here that because it says Putiel and not Putael, the yud is usually an indication of plural. And so that means trei pute, shmamina, that you actually have two meanings to the word Putiel over here. One is a drasha of Yosef, shepit peit v'yitzro. And the other one is tro, shepiteim agalim l'avodah zara. The Mishnah now continues with the description of going into battle and the speeches that were given to the troops before they entered the battle. In the psukim, it says, v'dibru ha-shotrim el-ha'am le'mor, that the shotrim, not the Kohen, but rather now the Shotrim, the sheriffs, or here the military police, whoever these individuals are, they say, Mi'i ha'ish asher bana bayit chadash, velo hanacho, yelech v'yashov lebeito. Someone who built a new house, didn't have a chance to inaugurate the house, he should go back home in order to inaugurate it. Echad ha'boneh beit ha'teven, beit ha'bakar, beit ha'itzim, beit ha'atzorot. Doesn't have to literally be a house. It could even be a silo, or a refet, a cow shed, a woodshed, or some sort of cellar or storage area. Echad ha'boneh, doesn't matter if you built it, v'echad ha'lokeach, or you purchased it. So even if it's a house that's already built or been in use, if for you it's a new house because you purchased a house, it has the same standing as building a new house. V'echad ha'yoresh, and similarly if you inherit the house, v'echad sh'nitan lo b'matana, or you got it as a gift. In any case, if it's a new house for you, even though the house itself is not new, that is sufficient grounds to return from the milchama. The Gemara will discuss the drasha. Now the psukim continue. Umi aish asher nata karem velo chilulo, who is someone who planted a vineyard and hadn't had a chance to redeem it, to bring up those monies to Yushalayim and to eat the Kerem Revai inside of Yerushalayim. Echad anotea Kerem, v'echad anotea chamisha ilanei ma'achal. So when we say Kerem here, Kerem doesn't only mean a Kerem in the sense of a vineyard, grapes. It means any type of fruit-bearing tree. And therefore, if you have five trees that produce fruit, then you would also have a din of Kerem. As Rashi, you can see in the picture in Rashi, it has to be set up as two, two, and then one coming out, which is called Shtaim Keneged Shtaim V'chat Yotze Zanav. Two, opposite two, and then one sticking out, because that defines it as a Kerem already. V'afilu mechameshet aminim. Even if it's from five separate species, meaning the trees do not have to be of the same fruit, it can be any fruit. Echad anotea. It's true if you're planting for the first time, you're putting a sapling in the ground. Echad amavrich. Or if you do it by putting the branch of the tree into the ground and bringing it up somewhere else. Echad amarkiv. Or you're grafting the tree. Echad alokeach. Or you purchase the tree. Echad ayoresh. Or you inherit the tree. Echad shenatano b'matana. Or it was given to you as a gift. Mi'aish asher iras isha. So here's the third category of people who are exempt from going out to battle. Someone who got engaged to a woman, but has yet to take her as a wife. Echad me'ares et abtula. This includes getting halachically engaged to a woman who is yet to be married. Echad me'ares et amana, or even if this individual is marrying a widow. Afilu shomeret yavam. Even if he is entering into a levirate marriage. Afilu shema shemit achiv. Bamilchama. Even if he gets word that his brother died in the battle, which means now that he is chayav biyubum because of the death of his brother, chuzer ubalo, he goes back from the battle because at that point his exemption then starts. Kol elu, probably the word ve'elu here as the box says is extraneous, kol elu shomim divrei kohen marchei milchama v'chuzrim. So all these individuals hear the kohen tell them this information, they go back home, they become part of the logistics of the army. They become the supply lines of the army. They have to provide food and water to the troops. And they fix the roads. They are exempt from combat, but they are still enlisted in the army to provide logistical support for the troops that are in combat. And these are the ones that do not go back. Habone Beit Sha'ar. Someone who builds an entrance way to the chatzer, which is basically the equivalent of a vestibule into the chatzer, so that you don't have to open the chatzer and then you walk straight into the chatzer. There is a little bit of a buffer where you have an area that allows the person to enter before they enter into the chatzer itself. And sometimes there was a guard that sat in that area, achsadra, which is a building like a gazebo, which it has a roof over it, but not walls around it. Umir Peset, which is a balcony. In their day, the balcony was usually used to access the second floor, which is that if you have houses on the ground floor and then houses on the second floor, you had a staircase that went up, and then a platform in front of those houses on the second floor, and that was the Mir Peset, which was the ability to access those houses on the second floor. Because these are not considered to be significant enough buildings, or a bayit, you're not allowed to return for these three items. Hanotea arba ilanei machal. If he only has four trees, it doesn't gain the status of a kerem. V'chamisha ilanei sarak. Or, even if he has five trees, but they're not fruit-bearing trees, then he doesn't return. Hamakzirat grushato. Someone who returns his divorcee does not return from the marchei milchama. Here, you may differentiate between makzir grushato, where he's fully married to the woman before, where he does not go back. Versus if he was only engaged to her halachically, he had erusin, divorced, and then marries her again, or gets halachically engaged to her again, over there you could argue that he should return, because they've never really been married, they only reached the point of erusin. So he's still at that point of erusin. Amana l'kohen gadol, grusha v'chalutza l'kohen ejot. These are examples of marriages that are inappropriate, that do not result in what we call likuchin, that they will not result in a proper marriage. And over there it says that a person who takes a wife, ulekacha, that he wants to take her to be a wife and a proper wife. So these are exempted or excluded from that exemption because they will not result in a proper marriage. So that's a widow to a kohen gadol, a divorcee, or someone who had chalitza performed them to a kohen ejot. What's interesting here is that This seems to indicate that the Kohanim were enlisted in the army as combat soldiers, because otherwise, why would they need to say here that this does not exempt them from going out to the Marchei HaMilchama? You could argue that it's just a list, which the Mishnah uses all the time. Everyone at time wants to talk about problematic marriages. You'll see here, this is the list that we've seen numerous times. You also could argue that the Kohanim may not be obligated to go into combat, but they can volunteer to go into combat. And here, if they volunteer to go in combat, they don't gain this exemption when they voluntarily go into combat. Right, so very good. So that's a good question. Who carried the Aron in these situations is a very good question. Was it the Levi'im that carried the Aron, or the Kohanim that carried the Aron? We find different descriptions about who carries the Aron. The distinction that the Gemara made earlier in Sotah, which seemingly is the difference between the Kohanim and the Levi'im, because the Kohanim carried the Aron through the Yardin, even though the Levi'im were the movers of the Aron. So what it seems is that when the Aron is being moved, in the sense of movers, that the Levi'im do. When the Aron is being moved for a religious reason, or is being utilized as the movement of the Shekhinah, then generally the Kohanim are involved. So when they go to split the Yardin, the Kohanim are carrying the Aron, because there the Aron is not being moved because they're transferring from location to location, but rather because that is what's going to cause the Yardin to split. So over here, you could argue, and that we have an example in Tanachov, is that the Kohanim should be carrying out the Aron here, because the Aron's not going out to move it from location to location, but rather to be a part of the battle. And that is borne out by the story by Bnei Eli. When the Aron is brought to the battle with the Plishtim, it's the Bnei Eli that bring the Aron out to the battle, because they're killed in the battle later on, that they were the ones who moved the Aron out there. So in all likelihood, you would assume that the Kohanim are coming out to bring their Aron. Maybe that is what they're discussing over here, that Kohanim will go out there, would be exempted from this service of bringing the Aron out, although it seems less likely that that would be what it's speaking about, rather than the combat soldiers, which is what the exemption is for over here. The Parshia is talking about a Mechemet Rishut, because we know that by Mechemet Mitzvah, afilu chatan mechedro, even a chatan goes out from his room, meaning even a newlywed individual goes out to battle. So here we're clearly talking about a Mechemet Rishut. The question I mentioned before, the question of whether Meshuach Milchama applies in Mechemet Mitzvah, clearly the Parshia in the Torah is talking about a Mechemet Rishut, and that's where Meshuach Milchama is mentioned, and all these speeches are mentioned. In the case of Mechemet Mitzvah, whether it applies or whether there is a Meshuach Milchama is not clear. Plus, it has to be that his speech is different. If he does have it, his speech has got to be different because all these exemptions don't apply. Obviously, he would have to give a different or an altered speech in order to be have a Meshuach Milchama by a Mechemet Mitzvah. All right, Mamzeret v'netina l'Yisrael. Again, these are all illicit or illegal marriages. A Mamzeret and Netina, who are not allowed to marry into Klal Yisrael, into the Kahal, married to Israel, or Bat Yisrael, the Mamzer and Natin, a Israelite who marries a Mamzer and Natin, are also precluded from the Kahal. Lo Ayachuzer. None of these individuals come back from their combat duty because their marriage is not a marriage that we want to promote or condone. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Af Bune Bayit Al Mechono Lo Ayachuzer. This is the precursor to the modern tax authorities, which is that if you rebuild a house, but you maintain the foundation that was there originally, it's not deemed to be a new house. So you don't need to get new variances and all the other permits because you're not building something new. The original foundation is in place and all you're doing is rebuilding the existing house. And so Rabbi Yehuda makes a similar case here, which is that if you're simply renovating the house or rebuilding the house that exists, it's deemed to be the original house and not a new house. Also, a person who builds a brick house in the area of the Sharon, he didn't go back. So the reason for that is that those houses did not have a long-lasting life. They usually collapsed within a couple of years. So therefore, it wasn't considered to be a bayit that has enough permanence that it would be significant enough to return from the Marchei HaMilchama for this. It's also what the Kohen Gadol says at his end of his tefillah on Yom HaKippurim, that Ulianche Sharon Shelo Yu Batehem Kivrehem, that their houses should not be their graves because they collapsed. Whether they collapsed simply because the construction was not up to code or because of the earthquakes in this area and the nature of the brick buildings didn't allow them to survive in cases of earthquakes, and therefore they were very vulnerable to those types of natural disasters, or whether just simply the bricks were not solid enough or did not hold well, and therefore over time they all collapsed. Elu shein zazim b'mkoman. So here is a list of individuals who go out to the battle and then are sent back from the battle. Now, the meaning of that is that they are still enlisted in the army, as we said before. They simply are not in combat roles. They become supportive roles. On the other hand, there are a group of individuals, she'en zazim b'mkoman, means they don't even go out to the battle. They're not enlisted in the army at all. They're completely exempt, which is bana bayit v'chanocho. He built a house and he inaugurated. He's living now in that new house. Nata kerem v'chilulo. He planted a vineyard and now it's the fourth year he redeemed it. Anoset arusato. He actually consummated the marriage with his arusa. And akoneset yivimto. And he marries his yivama shenemar. Why is this the case? Because we are reading the psukim until now from Parshat Shoftim. Later on in Parshat Kiteitzei, there's another rule, which is Naki Yad Beito Shana Achat. That over there it says that an individual gets married. This is what otherwise is known as Shana Rishona. In the first year of their married life, that individual is completely exempt from any service within the army in order to V'simachat Ishto, that he can stay and make his wife happy. So Gemara is going to darshan from this pasuk that it's not just about a marriage, but it's about all these other items that are mentioned in Parshat Shoftim, where you get an exemption from combat roles. These same items have the same exemption as a shana rishona for marriage, which is nakiya lebeito shana achat lebeito. Lebeito means ze beito, for a house. Iye ze karmo. Iye is a reboy to include his kerem, to include his vineyard. V'simach et ishto, zo ishto. That's literally his wife that he gets the exemption for. Asher lakach, lavi et yivimto. Lakach, the one that he took, means even his yivama. So these individuals, ein maspikim maimu mazon, ve'im etaknim et adrachim. It looks like this was not in the original Mishnah, but rather in addition, it happens to be true, but it's telling you, what does it mean that these don't go out to the battle at all? It means that they're exempt from being enlisted in the army whatsoever. They don't function in combat roles, and they don't function even in supportive or logistic roles in the army. So what you have here, the duration of this is a year, because that's what the pasuk says over there, shana rishona, that the husband is exempt from the army. The same is true if he inaugurates and lives in his new house for the first year he's living in the new house. Or in the fourth year of the vineyard's production, that's the year that he would be exempt from the army. It's the entire year that he would be exempt. Tan Rabbanan, v'dibru ashotrim, yachol dvarim shel atzman. You would think that they're saying their own words now, that they're speaking. K'shomer v'yasvu ashotrim, when it says over there that the shotrim now add on, harei dvarim shel atzman amur. That seems to be where the shotrim kick in. Ha'mani mikayim v'dibru ashotrim. Then what I do with the fact that it says v'dibru ashotrim, that the shotrim are speaking. V'divrei meshuach melchama katuv midaber. Speaking about the Kohen, the Moshiach Melchama's speech. Ha-ketzad. Well then, how do you resolve that? Kohen midaber, v'shoter mashmia. The Kohen is the speaker, but the shoter is, again, the equivalent of an amora. He's the loudspeaker. He's the conveyor of the information. And now the Gemara will explain this. Tani chado, we have one braita that says, Kohen midaber, v'shoter mashmia. Kohen speaks, and the shoter relays the information to the people. Tani idach, Kohen midaber, v'kohen mashmia. The Kohen, Meshuach Melchama, speaks, and the information is conveyed or relayed to the people through another Kohen. Danidach, we have a third braita, Shoter Midaber, Shoter Mashmia. That the sheriffs or the military police speak, and then it's relayed through another Shoter. Amar Abaye HaKetzad, how do we reconcile between these three disparate braitot? Mivni Gash Vad V'Dibru. So in the beginning of the parasha, ki teitzei la'melchama lo'evecha, chavarita sus v'rechev amrabim chalotzi ramihem, k'eshem lokecha imach, ha'malcha me'eretz Mitzrayim. V'haya k'korchevem el ha'melchama, v'nigash ha'kohen, v'diber al'am. So that's the beginning of the speech of the Kohen. Later on in the psukim it says, v'dibru ha'shotrim el'am le'mor mi'aish, and then goes through the exemptions. That v'dibru is the next section. And then later on, and finally, the last part of it, it says, v'yasfu. So the other exemptions, which are fear and someone who is of weak heart, then he also goes back. So that's the way that the Gemara is now going to divide up these sections of this parshia in the Torah. And says, "Vivni gashva dibru, kohen medaber kohen mashmia." That is fully the kohen's job. Over there it says, "Vivni gashva kohen." The kohen will go. So it's not only that the kohen is speaking, but he's also the one who is relaying the information. "Mivid dibru ad v'yasvu," from a dibru until yasvu, kohen medaber v'shoter mashmia. The kohen speaks, but the information is relayed through a shoter. "Mivid yasvu ve'elech," from Yeshua until the end of the parashia, Shoter Medaber v'Shoter Mashmia. And that's how we reconcile the Braita. And that's also why in the Mishnah it says the Kohen was speaking, even though it sounds like the Dibru HaShotrim. Even though it says the Shotrim are the ones who are speaking in the Torah, nevertheless it's the Kohen, because the Kohen is the one who is giving the speech, it's just the Shoter who is Mashmia in that case. Me'ayish asher bana bayit chadash, Tanur banan, asher bana, eini ele asher bana. That's only if he built it. Lakach v'yarash v'nitan lo b'matana minayin. How do I know that those are also included in this exemption? Tomalomar mi'aish asher ba'ana. So now, the way that Rashi reads it is that the word ha'ish is extraneous over here. And from the extraneous ha'ish, that's how we learn out all these other items are added. Others suggest the extraneous word here is asher. And so the asher is the extra word, and that's what gives you these additional items. Bayit. Ein li'ala bayit. That's only true of a house. That's what's written in the Pesuk. I mean, either about Beta Tevin, Beta Bakar, Beta Yitzim, Beta Otzorot. How do I know that these other buildings or extensions on the house are sufficient grounds to return from your combat role? Tamalomar Asher Bana Mikol Makom. Says that you built. That you built means any way that is built. The way that Rashi learns it is that the way that the Pesuk says it is, Mi'aish asher bana bayit chadash, v'lo chanacho yelech v'yashov lebeito. So Rashi says, it could have said, asher bayit bana, that a house he built. The fact that it puts the verb first, asher bana bayit, comes to teach you asher bana means anything that you build. Yocho shani mirabe afa bone beit she'ar aksadro mirpeset. You would think that you include any type of building. Now that you're making it more inclusive than a house, then she could do these items as well. Tamalomar, bayit. That's the point of having the word bayit there. It has to have some meaning. What's the meaning? Ma bayit haro'uy ledira. Just like a house which is useful or can be utilized to live in. Afkol haro'uy ledira. So too, all these other buildings are buildings that are of a size or significance that they are part of a living space of the individual and not simply extensions that are not considered to be living space, like the Beit Shar, the Echsadra, and the Mirpeset. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov omer, bayit kemashma'o. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says, bayit means literally a house. And the meaning is house. And that's the only thing that you get an exemption for, according to Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. The question now, whether the next statement belongs to Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, or belongs to everyone, seemingly it's everybody says this, but you could argue, and we'll see later on in the Gemara, maybe there's a reason to believe that it's Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov's statement. Lo chineich, v'lo hanacho. It could have written that he did not inaugurate it. But it says chanacho as if there's some sort of possessive form of this. It's a chanicha shelo. It's his inauguration. What do we learn from that? Prat gazlan. That comes to exclude a gazlan. If you stole the house, and now it's your inaugural year in the house that you stole, you do not come back from the marchei hamilchama. Mar says, lema deloka Rabbi Yossi Aglili. This makes it sound like this explanation or understanding is not like Rabbi Yosef Glili. Di Rabbi Yosef Glili Amar. He says, Barach Halevav. What does this mean that someone who's faint of heart? Zeh mitcherei me'averot shebiado. This is someone who's afraid of the sins that he has in his hands. So if he has sins, he returns. Well, if he's a gazlan, he sure has a sin on his hands and he's going to have to return anyway. Forget about because of the bayit. He's going to return because he is a gazlan. It says, Afilu tem Rabbi Yosef Glili kagon tabat shuva. He did tshuva, so now he's no longer a problem in terms of being a gazlan. And he didn't return the house, but he paid for it, and that is his tshuva. Then if he paid for it, then he becomes the equivalent of a purchaser of the house. And then he should go back because he bought a new house. Even though originally he stole it, but now he's paying for it. And in paying for it, he basically purchased a house. And if a purchaser of a house is exempt. It says, came to Mikara b'torat gzela atali a day lo. It's basically equivalent of mitzvah ba'aveira, in a sense, which is since the gzela is the source or the core behind why he owns this house, despite the fact now that he's paying for it and he's considered to be a lokeach, he will not garner the status of lokeach for the exemption from the army because it started out as a stolen house. Now, how he steals the house is not exactly clear because we have a general principle, engzela bakarko. So how does he steal it over here? So either you have to say is that he stole the land, but then he built his own house on it. So as far as the house is concerned, it's his house, but it's built on stolen land. And that's what the problem is over here. He built a house, which is his house, but it's sitting on stolen land, which means that the land still belongs to someone else. So that's the problem. Or it could be that if he is a strong man who basically once he's taken possession of the property, you're never going to get it back, then sometimes the Balim have Yeush, and the possibility is that they do give up ownership or relinquish ownership to this individual, and therefore there is Gzela Bekarka. The general principle of Gzela Bekarka or in Gzela Bekarka is because Karka doesn't move. Since it doesn't move, you can't steal it. You can't move it somewhere else and steal it, and everybody knows it belongs to the original owner. But there are some circumstances where the person who takes it over is so powerful or so significant that the previous owner can't get his karka, can't get his land back. Miyaish asher nata kerem, who is the individual who planted a vineyard? Tan Rabbanan, asher nata, ein li ela nata. That's only true if he planted it. Lakach viyarash, v'nitein lo b'matana, minayin. V'nitein lo b'matana, minayin. How do I know? Tamalomar, miyaish asher nata kerem, who is the person who planted a vineyard. Now, again here, the question of whether the ribui is from Miyaish or Asher would be the same question we had before, but that's the ribui. In the Ela Kerem, Minayin Rabot, Chamisha Ilanei Machal, Vafilu Mishar Minim. How do I know that it's inclusive of items besides grapes or a vineyard that any fruit trees would qualify over here? Tamalomar Asher Nata, that he planted. Again, as Rashi notes over here, the order of the words is important because it could have said Asher Kerem Nata, a vineyard he planted. Instead, it puts the verb first, which is nata, kerem, to focus on the verb itself. Asher nata means any way that it's planted. Or a broader definition of kerem here, kerem is not simply a vineyard, it's any orchard, it's any fruit trees. You would think it would include even four fruit trees. Or five non-fruit-bearing trees. Tamalomar, kerem. That's the point of the word kerem. The word kerem comes to teach you that it's not any tree. It's only fruit-bearing trees that form a kerem that qualify for the exemption. So that comes about either because you have a vineyard or because you have fruit trees that are similar to a vineyard. It's set up an orchard that is considered to be an orchard and not just individual trees. It happens to be that the word kerem is used by Ilanot also, but that will be a machloket that we'll see, which is a Belezim and Yaakov Omer, kerem kemashmo. Kerem means literally a kerem and not any other fruit trees. So Rabbi Lezman Yaakov is of that opinion, not only here, but throughout Shas. Meaning that when it says that you have kerem revai, he thinks that the fruits in the fourth year, it literally means kerem revai. It's only referring to grapes or a vineyard. It doesn't apply to other fruits. On the other hand, the other day, I believe it's netta revai. Anything that's planted as a fruit tree will qualify for orla and kerem revai, because the word kerem has a broader definition. But here, Rabbi Lezman Yaakov sees kerem as being simply the definition of a grape vineyard. Lo chilel velo chilelo. Same question we had before, the possessive form of chilel. Prat lemavrich ulemarkiv. This comes to exclude a case where he took a branch and planted it back into the ground and took it out somewhere else. Or markiv, or grafting. Either of those do not qualify. Mar says, va'anan stan, echad anotea, v'chad amavrich, v'chad amarkiv. Our Mishnah said it didn't matter whether he planted it, whether he put it into the ground, took it out somewhere else, or Markiv, he grafted it. So Reb Zera, Reb Chista, lo kasho. No, the Mishnah, our Mishnah and this Brayta are talking about different cases. Kan bar kavat isur. The case in the Brayta is a case where the grafting was done improperly. It was done as an isur. Kan bar kavat heter. The harkava, the grafting of our Mishnah, is a case where it was permitted grafting. Hai harkavat heter hechidami. So then, what is permitted grafting versus restricted grafting? Ilema yalada biyalda, that it's a case where you take a young tree and you graft it with another young tree. Young here means under the years of Orla, in the first 3 years of being planted. So if you take a new branch from a tree, that is under 3 years old, and you put it into a base of a tree that you're grafting onto that's also under 3 years old, then he has to come back because of the base of the tree. The tree that he's grafting onto is a sapling still within its first 3 years, and that would entitle him to return from the combat role independent of the grafting over here. Ella yalda miskeina. Must be a case where the branch you're putting in is new, but the core, the base, or the trunk that you're grafting onto is an older tree, which is already past the years of Orla. Vama Rabbi Yubo, yalda shesibcha bizkeina, bitela yalda bizkeina. A young branch that is grafted onto an older tree, then the new branch is batel to the older tree, vein badin Orla. And therefore there's no din of Orla on the grafted branch that's put in there. It's batel to the core, to the trunk, which is already past that age. So if he puts in a young branch into the older tree, then he's not returning because it doesn't get the shame of Orla, and then there'll never be any Neter Revai here. And Rabbi Yirmiyahu Olam Yalda Bialda, it's a case where it's a young branch being placed into a young base, it's being grafted in there. Ukugon de nata lahachamaita li siag ulukorot. But the original tree was planted either as a fence, a border, or for its wood. So it wasn't planted for its fruit production. Rather, it was placed there because there was a breach in the wall or the boundary and they wanted to put up a tree to block that out. Or he wanted the wood from this tree. That's not an onoteya de siago de korot. Someone who plants a tree specifically as a border or for its wood, but tur min orla, then he doesn't have a din of orla. Umayshna yalda biskeina de betela. Why is it when you take a young branch and you graft it onto an older tree that it's batel to the trunk? Umayshna yalda biyalda. How come in this case where you take a branch from a young tree and graft it onto another young tree where the original trunk was something that was patur from orla because the original trunk was planted as a fence or for its wood? Delo betela. But over there you say it's not batel. How come? Hotam imimlich Allah labat mihadarhi. But the case of this kena, no matter what he thinks or how much he changes his mind, this kena will never be chayevet in orla. That older tree is past the point of orla and will never be in the world of orla again. On the other hand, hocha imimlich Allah, over here in the case where he made it for the fence or for the wood, bat mihadarhi, he does have the ability to enter into a world of being chayevet in orla, which is that if he changes his mind, and now he says, forget it, I'm not going to use it for the fence, or I'm not using it for its wood. And now the primary purpose becomes a fruit tree, then the orla will go into effect in the first 3 years of that sapling's life. If he changes his mind about the status of the tree then would become a tree of orla. So since it has the possibility of becoming orla, I mean, of course, until he decides that that's the case, it won't be orla. But then when you graft a young branch on top of it, you can't say it's batel to the trunk or the core that was there already, because the core that's there already is questionable about what its status is. Right now, it's patur min orla, but it could be chayav in orla with just a change of a mind. And since that's the case, it would not be mevato, the new branch that is grafted onto it. Dami kara le peirei kaima, because from the beginning, a fruit tree is for its fruit. Mida dehava alu me'alehem. It's the equivalent of a tree that grows by itself. The tzan alu me'alehem chayavin borla. The tree grows by itself, then it's still chayav in orla in the first 3 years. And similarly over here, where he planted the tree for an alternate reason, if he then decides that he wants it to be a fruit tree, it's the equivalent of a tree growing by itself, or showing up by itself, and it will be subject to orla. Now, the Gemara here never deals with the issue of havracha, or the stira in havracha. How come the Mishnah and the Braita have a stira in havracha, and yet they don't reconcile it? But that might be because the answer to that question is very easy, which is by havracha, where you take a branch, you reinsert it into the ground and bring it up somewhere else so that that branch will become root in the ground. The Mishnayot tell us that the status of that branch depends on whether it's still drawing its sustenance from the original tree or the original vine. As long as it's still attached to the parent, we'll call it over here, then it has the status of the parent. Only once it's severed from the parent does it gain its own independent status. And that's the difference over here. In the case of our Mishnah, where the Har Kavah, the Havracha is considered to be a new netiyah, that's in a case where it's severed from the parent. On the other hand, in the case of the Braita, where it says you can't go back from it, that's where it's still attached to the parent tree. Gemara says, V'lukma b'kerem shel shnei tshutafim. Just make it easy. Just say that they're partners here. One partner owns the core of the base tree. The other partner owns the tree that they're grafting over here. And the reason he can't come back for the base tree is because the base tree isn't his. It belongs to someone else. So that's why he only gets his exemption from putting the grafted branch on. Gemara says, the high hadar aditei, high hadar aditei. Each one of them will return for their own part of this tree. The owner of the tree will return because this tree is young. The person who's grafting will return because he's grafting his branch onto this tree. So Rav Papa Zoto merits, what you conclude from this is the fact that the Gemara did not give this answer is, Kerem shel shnei shutafim in chozrim elav me'archei ha-milchama. That if you have a kerem that belongs to partners, you do not return from the battle or the combat roles in this situation. Umay shna mechamisha achim. Why is this any different than five brothers? Umay techad mehem b'milchama. And one of them is killed in the battle. The kulan chozrim. They are all then exempt from combat roles because each one of them could be the yavam for this yavama now that was created by the death of their brother. Over there, every one of them has a status with this woman to be called his wife. Because any one of the brothers could marry the woman and become the Yavam. So since any one of them could become the Yavam, it's as if they all have this exemption of Yavamah. In this case, where you have partners, it's not called your Kerem. It's not your Kerem because it also belongs to your partner. And therefore, it doesn't qualify because it's not your Kerem. Rav Nachman Rana Yisrael Amar B'Mavrich Ilan B'Yerek says the case is where he did Havracha, he did grafting of a tree onto a vegetable. V'hai Tanahu, and it's this Tana. What's the problem? If you graft a tree onto a vegetable, you have Kilayim because you're bringing two species together. So if it's Kilayim, then you wouldn't come back because you have a new tree here. You're going to come back because you have an Aveira in your hands, which is that you have now created Kilayim. Someone who puts a tree into a vegetable. He said, Rav Shimon Gamliel says in the name of Rav Yehuda ben Gamdo that it's mutar, that that's not considered to be a problem of kilayim. Chamim osrim, and the chamim say that it is problematic. This answer would be according to that opinion who says that to place a tree into a vegetable is okay. Since it's okay, now the branch or the tree that's growing above will give you an exemption to come back, whereas the base, the yerek, which is the base, would not have granted you that exemption to come back. Kiata Rav Dimi, Amar Rav Yochanan. So Rav Dimi is one of those Amoraim that travels between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael. And the Gemara, his main role is bringing Memrod from Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael to the people of Bavel. Kiata Rav Dimi, Rav Yochanan. Hamani, Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakovi. It's Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov who says when you say the word Kerem, it literally means Kerem. Lo amar Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov hatam Kerem kemashmo. Didn't Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov say when you have the word Kerem, it means literally Kerem? Hachanami nata kemashmo. So too he takes the word nata literally, which is noteya in marvrich umarkiv lo. Only if you plant the sapling is that the case. But if you do havracha or harkava, grafting or putting the branch back into the ground, those don't qualify. So that'll explain the Braita, where the Braita says that if you do Harkava or Havracha, it does not exempt you. That's the Shita at Reb Lezer ben Yaakov. So that's what I said to you before. It's not clear that the statements at the end of the Braita, whether they belong to Reb Lezer ben Yaakov or not. Because what we're seeing here is Reb Lezer ben Yaakov takes this very literally. And therefore he'll take each word literally and becomes a miut based on Reb Lezer ben Yaakov. So over here, when it says kerem, it means a vineyard. When it says nata, it means to plant, and those are the only times that you get exemptions. Kiyat Rav Dimi Rav Yochanan. So again, we have Rav Dimi coming, bring a member from Yochanan, Mishun Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov. The reason it's brought here is because it's also Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov. Yaldab chutami tefach. If you have a vine or a tree that is less than a tefach, chayevet bo'orla. It has a din of orla, kol shnotea, for the entirety of its lifespan. And this is a vine or a tree, which is basically a mini. It never grows to full size. It always remains this small size. So since it remains this small size, it always looks like it's a brand new tree. And for that reason, the Rabbanan said, because of that Marat Ayin, that it has a din of orla for its entire lifespan. The Marat says, k'demit chazek t'kebat shata, because it always looks like it's a sapling in its first year of life. V'ani mile shtayim k'neged shtayim v'achat yotza zanav. It's only true where the Karam that you're defining over here is two opposite two and one sticking out, like the picture of Rashi in the Mishnah. About Kule Karam Kala Itlai. If the entire vineyard is made up of these types of vines, the entire orchard is made up of these types of trees, then already it's something that's well known to the public. It's an oddity. Since it's an oddity, people will notice it and know that. And so they'll know that these trees or these vines are not subject to Orla because they're much older. And the reason that they haven't grown bigger is simply because that's the nature of these trees or these vines. And again, another memra in this fashion. Mate tofes arba amot l'kriyat shema. A mate has four amot, wherever the mate is buried, or wherever the mate is. Four amot around them is also considered to be the space of the mate. And therefore, you're not allowed to read Kriyat Shema in that space. The Gemara says here, "Dechtiv loeg larosh cheref osehu," that a person who makes fun of the poor, cheref osehu, he is a curse or blasphemed to his creator, his master. It's totally inappropriate to do something that makes fun of someone who is in a more difficult circumstance. So over here, the mate is unable to accomplish mitzvot. So if you go ahead and do a mitzvah within his sphere, then you're making fun of him, because he can't do the mitzvah, you can do the mitzvah. So we dare you to stay more than four amot away, in order that it's not, you're not in his space. And therefore it's not considered to be making fun of him. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. So now we have more memorot from Yochanan and the name of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, but now it's Rabbi Yitzchak who's bringing them rather than Rabbi Dimi. Churgata Hagdela ben Achim. A stepdaughter that grows up in a household with boys. She cannot marry her stepbrothers. Despite the fact that they have no blood relationship and there's no arayot over here, the stepdaughter cannot marry one of her stepbrothers. Because from the outside, it looks like she is a member of the family, that she is a daughter to this couple. And because of that, you can't marry because it looks like a sister marrying a brother in that case. Velohi, it's just not true. Kala itle the milta. It's something that is well known publicly if this person has a stepdaughter living together with the sons or with her stepbrothers. It's well known that they have no relationship, and if they get married, it's not going to look like a brother got married to a sister. Leket shichcha upeya shasan bigoren, an ani who collected leken shichcha upeya over the whole season. He's been collecting, and now he has enough to make a goren, enough to make a pile or to bring it to a threshing floor. Hukvu the maser. They become chayavin in maser midrabanan. Leket shichcha upeya matnotaniyim in general are pterot from shumot and masrot because the kohen and the levi have a chilek in those items because they were originally hefker to any who takes it. So when the any takes it, they're pterim from maser. Amrumra lo amran ela basadet. It's only true if he does it out in the field. Aval beir kala itle the milton. But in the city, it's clear what happened here. He brought him in piece by piece, and his neighbors can see him doing that. So they know that when he makes a big goren, it's not because he harvested it, but it's rather it's the sum total of his collections that he made through the season. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Yolda pchuta mitefach. Again, this tree or vine that is less than a tefach. Eina mikadesh et dezerim. It does not cause them to become kilei hakerem. V'hani milei shtayim keneged shtayim. V'chatz yotzei zanav. That's only true when you have two versus two and one sticking out. Aval kulei kerem magdish. If it's an entire kerem, then it is magdish. It does become a problem of kilei hakerem. So this is interesting because, in a sense, why should it matter? If it's deemed to be a kerem, then it's a kerem full-fledged. And if it's a full-fledged kerem, then it's a sur. So why in the case where you have a kerem that comes because of five vines that are set up in this structure versus a whole big vineyard, why should it make a difference? They both should create kilayim. So the answer to that question, the way Rashi says it is, Yili kasavar, kanamrina menachot kanvus velof asra Torah. That the only isur min haTorah for kilei hakerem is if you planted canvas and loaf in that area. Shar zerim midrabanan. Other zeras only midrabanan. And the rabbanan will only go there in certain cases. In a case where you have these miniature vines, they only go there if you have a full vineyard of it. But if you just have a small number of them, five of them, that even though they're set up in a way that would be deemed a vineyard, there they would not go there. Others suggest that it's the threshold. That normally, to be considered a kerem, you would have to have a full vineyard.
the din that five vines together in this pattern is considered to be a kerem is only a din derabonan. So it's only a din derabonan. They don't apply it over here by the case of these miniature vines. The Rabbanan didn't invoke that principle. According to the Rambam, on the other hand, the din of the five here is like any other din of shiurim in a Torah. It's halacha l'moshe misinai, that once you cross over five, it's deemed to be a kerem. And so then what you have to suggest over here is that maybe what the Rambam believes is that these miniature vines are p'turot from being considered a kerem at all. They don't have a din of kerem at all. The only question is, they're abonim, where they go there, when it's a full vineyard of these miniatures, they called it a kerem, even though these are not considered to be vines because of their shape or their style. Nevertheless, the Chachamim imposed on them and said that's the case. So in any one of these cases, you have to figure out a way to differentiate between a full kerem and five. And the only way you could do that is to determine that one of them is a din derabonan. And since a din derabonan, the rabbanon could decide when they want to apply it or not apply it. Rabbi Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yochan, Mishum Rabbi Lez Ben Yaakov. So it's the last memra that we have from Rabbi Yochan and Rabbi Lez Ben Yaakov. Mate tofes arba amot tuma. A mate gets four amot around him for tuma. Meaning, the Chachamim instituted that wherever a mate is buried, four amot around the mate, you're not allowed to enter if you are restricted in Tumah, like a Kohen, or if you don't want to become Tumei. If you enter that space, you'll be Tumei, mate, midrabanan. But the Chachamim we're trying to do is create a harchoka, which is that if we allow you right up to the area of the mate, what's going to happen is, by accident, you're going to lean over and put your hand over, and then you're mahila la mate, and you are Tumei, Tumah, Tumei. So in order to prevent those accidental ohels from happening, they basically created a perimeter around the mate and says that that perimeter is deemed to be Tameh, like Tumah Tameh. Don't enter that. That's a chokka from getting to Tumah Doraita. When this applies, it's a machokka between the Rif, Rabbeinu Yonatan. Rabbeinu Yonatan says that it only applies to a mate that is out and not properly buried, but someone who's in a kever, in a proper kever, it does not apply to. The Rif, on the other hand, says that it even applies to someone who is properly buried because the issue is there, even in a proper burial. We don't want you getting so close to the kever, at which if you stuck your hand over, you'd become tamei, tuma tameit, midoraita. So Mar says, Vitani tuna. When we were learning the Mesechta Ohalot, we had chatzer hakever homeid b'tocha tohor. In the courtyard to the burial cave, if you stand there, you are tohor. V'hu she'eba arba amot. That is if it has a minimum of four amot by four amot the chatzer. Divrei Beit Shemai, Beit Olamim, Arba'a Tfachim. It doesn't have to be 4x4 Amot, it can be even 4x4 Tfachim. Because 4x4 Tfachim already gives it its own status, significance in itself, which separates it away from the burial cave. So now, what we're speaking about here is, you have a burial cave. The way that they built the burial caves was that they chiseled, quarried out of the bedrock, a cave. And then within the cave, they have, to the sides, each wall, they dig out these catacombs, these burial slots where they put the mate. So you have a central area in the cave, and then off that central area in the cave, there are these kuchim, which are the areas where they bury the mateim. And there are a number of these around, another central chatzer, which we'll get to in Baba Batra, exactly how they look, what they're shaped like. If you're inside of the cave, you are tamei, period. Doesn't really matter because you share a common roof with the mate, no matter where you are in the cave. Now, there's a chatzer. In order to descend into the burial cave, what they used to do was they used to excavate into the ground and basically dig out an area around the entrance of the cave, which was known as the chatzer, the courtyard to the cave. What we learned here about the Mishnah and Olot is that that entranceway to the cave, that chatzer, doesn't have a din of tumatamet because it's considered to be separate or significant in of itself because there's a doorway there. The doorway to the cave creates a clear delineation between the chatzer and the cave. Therefore, you're not going to accidentally stick your hand into the cave or go into the cave because it's a clear demarcation as where it ends. It's similar to what we do with a mavoi. When you put a korah or a lechi there, that's the end of the mavoi, which goes out to Mishut Rabim. The korah, the lechi, indicates that this is the end, and a person's not going to make a mistake to go beyond that. So same thing over here. There's a natural border. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel argue about the size of the chatzer in order to gain its independence from the cave or its own significance. Beit Shammai says it's 4x4 amot. Beit Hillel says it's 4x4 tfachim. Now, the Mishnah is qualified. That's only true when the doorway is to enter the cave is from above. If it opens from the side, divrei hakol arba amot. You need 4x4 amot. The Gemara here says, klapei layo. It should be just the opposite, as Rashi explains over here. Kenegede fo afachta devarecha. How did you flip your words around? Meaning that it's backwards. Adarabo, it should be just the opposite. Minatzad, when you enter from the side. So there were two ways to have a chatzer. You can have a chatzer that sits on top of the cave, or you have a chatzer that sits on the side of the cave. So the question is, how do you descend to the cave? Do you descend into the cave through a hole in the roof of the cave? Or descend into the cave through a decline that goes into a courtyard that then has an entrance into the side of the cave? And that's how you enter the cave. So what the qualification of this Mishnah says is that machloket beit shemayim beit hillel is only when you're entering from the top of the cave. But when you enter from the side of the cave, everybody agrees you need 4x4 amot. The Gemara says it should be just the opposite. Adarabah, minatzad midrid v'nafik. When you go from the side, you descend slowly in towards the cave. Milamala, yevshar delomayil. When you enter from above, it's almost impossible that you're not going to be mahil. Because how do you descend into the cave? You hold yourself up, and then you descend into the cave. You want to come out of the cave? You have to put your arms out over the sides and pull yourself up. So by definition, you're going to be spreading your body beyond the entranceway to the cave. So over there, it's more likely that you'll be mahil, and therefore it should need a bigger chatzer in order to exempt it from this din of tumah. Whereas when you enter from the side, it's clear that you come down, you're not mahil on the cave at all, and it's clear where the doorway of the cave is. Over there, Beit Hillel should allow it to be a separate entity, even with a smaller amount of space. And so that's what the Gemara says, it's backwards. Ela, b'med dvarim mamurim, it has to be read this way. Shepitcha min atzad. When is it true that the machlok beit shemayim beit Hillel exists? Is when the opening or the entrance is from the side of the cave. So the chatzer sits at that entranceway. Above, pitcha mim lamalo, if it opens up from above, arba amot, then you need 4 amot in order for that chatzer to gain its own significance. V'ani mili chatzer akever, demisayme mechitzata. That's only true when you're talking about a chatzer in front of a grave, because there is a clear delineation as to where the chatzer ends. Avameit ba'almo, tofis. So basically, this is the proof from this. It took us this far to get here to show that there's a difference between the chatzer, where there's a clear delineation, versus a mate that's out there where there is no clear delineation, and therefore the mate is tofes arba amot, similar to what we saw in the member from Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov. Okay, we'll stop here by the two dots on the top of Mem Dalet Amud Aleph.